Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies Holiday Special, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, or as I remember to say some of the times, because it's not written down on this piece of paper, basically films you could have watched during the VHS era, basically. So here we are, Holiday Special. And our film for this episode is the classic. Oh, that's question one for the thing. Anyway, I ruined the whole podcast already. Our film is The Night of the Hunter from 1955. And we have it on Criterion Laserdisc. Getting it from, well, this is one of the many Laserdiscs that showed up in an orange milk crate on our porch one night.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they didn't even ring the doorbell. I just looked out, and there was an orange milk crate. I think I have my suspicions who left that orange milk crate there. That Secret Santa.
Yes.
And yes, and we have it on, yes, this Laserdisc, so it's obsolete format. And we're doing it on Christmas. It is Christmas 2020, and here we are. And the reason why, I think, is, you know, let's face it. Saying Die Hard's a Christmas movie, it's edgy mainstream now.
Yeah.
It's conformist edgy. It's, you know, it's no longer a fringe thing. So if you're one of those people who's like, Die Hard's a Christmas movie because it's alternative and weird, yeah, and you probably bought the post-load Metallica albums and are maybe like thinking that the Red Hot Chili Peppers make you a little badass. So if you're picking Die Hard as a Christmas movie for like edginess, you gotta try a little harder. We did. Thus, The Night of the Hunter, which, if people haven't seen this film, there is at least one part of the film that is in the DNA of American pop culture,
yeah,
where you get the reference, even if you haven't seen the film, which you really should, which is, of course, Robert Mitchum as the psychotic preacher with love and hate tattooed on his knuckles.
Yep.
It's been referenced in The Simpsons. I guess there's a Bruce Springsteen song that he talks about. But that image of just Robert Mitchum, psychopath, preacher, love, hate on the knuckles, it's that film.
It's even in Do the Right Thing, I think. He even has the, not tattooed, but he has the rings that say love, hate.
Yeah.
So that, I think.
And it's also, I believe, in Blues Brothers, Jake have?
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Tattoos on his knuckles. Plot of this film real quick. Or I think setting. There's so much to talk about with this film. It's 1930s America, and it's 1930s Northern West Virginia Panhandle, Ohio River. This is kind of a local film.
Yes.
Peter Graves, actually, in a very early role for Peter Graves.
Very brief early role.
Yes, plays this, you know, bank-robbing dad,
yep,
who has $10,000 in cash. Which I did an inflation calculator. That's $190,000 in today's money.
Wow.
So he's got 10 grand in mid-30s money. He's bleeding. The police are on the way. And he hides this money in his daughter's doll and tells the oldest son, or the only son, the older child, protect your sister and don't tell anybody where the money is.
Yeah.
And he goes to Moundsville Penitentiary, which is a place we've gone as tourists now several times.
Yes.
You can go tour Moundsville Penitentiary, where they did aerial shots, at least, of... And Moundsville Penitentiary is this dark, foreboding, evil place where in a little over 100 years, 150 years of use, over 1,000 people died. There was an electric chair. There were many hangings. Many, just very violent prison, very tough prison. And, okay, slight suspension of disbelief. They put the death row inmate, because the Peter Graves dad character killed two people to rob this money, in with a guy serving a 30-day sentence for stealing a car.
An itinerant preacher.
Who is an itinerant preacher.
Supposedly.
Supposedly.
Who goes from town to town. Preaching
and other things.
Revivalist you know, fire and brimstone type of preacher.
Yes.
Who has a side hustle. That's not very preacherly.
Yes. More on that later.
Yeah.
So he finds out that there is this money. The police never found the money. And so after his 30-day sentence is out, he goes to the family, and very quickly, right? I mean, Peter Graves is hung like nothing.
Yeah.
You know, justice is swift. And goes to his widow, played by Shelley Winters.
In this, like, amazing, understated performance. Because, like, I always think of the sinking ship movie that she... Poseidon. The Poseidon Adventure. Where she's, like, so over the top. I think we all remember that. Shelley Winters, over the top, almost screeching type of acting. This is a beautifully understated performance. She does an amazing job in this particular role.
Yes. And he figures, I'm going to marry her. I'm going to find this money because she probably has the money. It's going to be my money.
Yeah.
And turns out, how much do we spoil the film or not? Well, no, I got to say. So he finds out that the son knows.
Yeah.
And so Shelley Winters has to be gotten rid of. These kids got to be gotten rid of. But first, Robert Mitchum, as the evil, evil preacher, has to figure out where the money is. He's definitely going to kill these kids. The kids go on the run, and they hop in a little boat, and they float down the Ohio River and end up at the house of shotgun-toting Lillian Gish, who is just amazing Hollywood royalty, if you don't know about her career. I mean, she goes back to the silent days. She was the It Girl. She was...
The queen of silent cinema.
The queen of silent cinema, the biggest female actress of that era.
Yeah.
Now playing this incredible role as this, like...
Gun-toting granny.
Gun-toting granny that takes in strays.
Yeah.
Because it's the 30s and everyone is unsettled on the road. And the movie ends on Christmas, so it's a Christmas movie.
We're saying it's a Christmas movie, man.
We're saying it's a Christmas movie. I'll argue more about Christmas movie later. But that's the plot. For those of you who haven't seen it, you should really see this movie, though. Though it was a critical and commercial flop in 1955, I think, and it was the only movie Robert Ludlum got to direct because of that, which is...
Charles
Laughton, sorry. Robert Ludlum, where did I get that from? The only film Charles Laughton got to direct, and what a loss that is for us.
Yeah, it's this amazing film, and it incorporates a lot of German impressionist...
Yes.
And it's just an amazing...
It's this German impressionist film noir. Expressionist film noir.
Yeah.
Kind of party pack combo where there's just these incredible shots of nature, though most of the river, which is kind of impressive. Most of the scenes where the kids are on the river are is obviously shot in a soundstage.
Right.
Which is amazing. It's like, let's make a river inside. It'll be great. But that was filmmaking in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
So there's these amazing film noir shots. There's elements of horror in the film, especially in Robert Mitchum's performance.
Yeah. I mean, Charles Laughton does this amazing job of building this horrible tension. And he uses shadow and song and, you know, all of those classic
and this sort
things.
Of allegorical natural imagery.
Yeah.
You know, there's this great scene towards the end of the film where an owl takes out a rabbit, which is a metaphor for, you know, Robert Mitchum's character is hunting these children.
Yeah.
The Night of the Hunter is literally the night he corners these kids in this farmhouse.
Yeah.
And he's going to kill them.
Yeah.
Once he gets the money. Now, because at that point, he knows where the money is.
Yeah.
And he's going to kill those kids and get that money.
So now this film is a cult film. It's highly respected. It's on the list of... It's always cited in the list of top movies. You know, sometimes it's actually been ranked second to Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
So this film is now, in retrospect, because I don't think audiences were ready for it, because he was referencing silent films in many ways, German expressionism. Were Americans in the 50s ready for German expressionism to be brought to the mainstream?
And I think also in Roger Ebert's review of this, points this out too, is like, and I think this is something we can think about today and we should think about today, is the reckoning of the 1930s.
Right.
Americans, when you plant the flag of time for when America was America, it's the 1950s. It's this moment of prosperity, conformity, consumerism.
Right.
And America really feeling its wild oats and having, you know, this great economic surplus. And, you know, because the rest of the world had just been bombed to smithereens. So, you know, we had great prosperity in this country. And the thing that Ebert argues, and I think this is a thing that I think Americans still struggle with when we think about that era of what the Depression was like.
Yeah.
How heartbreaking, unsettling deprivation. I mean, this idea, you know, there's scenes where they stop at someone else's riverside house and she's just like, oh, so many children on the road. The woman is like fatigued by this. And she's like, I can give you one potato. And these kids eat raw potatoes and that's their food. That there's just chronic hunger, chronic families sort of split apart, thus these kids just kind of being on the run.
Well, I mean,
or roaming.
Yeah.
Even the Lillian Gish character note mentions that, like, her son's gone.
Yeah.
Like, he's gone and left looking for work, and
who knows?
Who knows what happened to him?
Yeah.
And that was life in this country at one time. And we don't like to think, I don't think we still want to think about that now.
Yeah.
Or as we perhaps are in 2020, late 2020, teetering on the edge of some kind of great disaster.
Well, I think there's also that near history that is hard for people, right? So, you know, it's a film from the 1950s referencing something that's only 20 some years ago, right? At that point in time. And so thinking about that was your most recent history, was this experience. So now we almost have 100 years difference between that. But as you said, we are facing our own depression now.
Yeah, I mean, even just the existence of chronic systemic poverty in this country that people just don't think about and don't want to think about. And it's just, it's there.
Yeah.
You can find it. You can find it in West Virginia. You can find it in Pittsburgh. You can find it 8 blocks from this house that we're in. And that's hard. And I think it also is interesting for me is that the way the film unsettles nostalgia and the good old days and the idea of the nuclear family then.
Yeah.
Because a big part of the plot point, well, two big parts of the plot point that make this, you know, if you think about it, and Kane too, number one, if it's Citizen Kane's number one, Night of the Hunters number two, both films really explore, during the good old days, they really explore the underbelly and these maybe short circuits in our culture.
Yeah.
And one of them being that it's how soon after her husband is hung in Moundsville Prison is the community, is her family pressuring Shelley Winters, you need a husband, you need a husband. And that also, let's face it, and it's a nice sly, like, how did he get this past the production code? Sort of sly thing that anything dressed up in Christianity, people are not critical about.
Right.
People are just openly accepting of these sort of false prophets.
Yeah.
Which is something America has always struggled with and is really struggling with now.
Yeah.
Here's a film from, again, 1955. Where you have a false prophet who, whenever he gets into trouble, can quote scripture and win people over.
Right. Well, I think that's literally how the movie starts, right? With the quote from the Bible about false prophets. It's exactly Lillian Gish saying that at the very, very beginning of the film. So this character, Harry Powell, is that correct? Because it's actually based on a serial killer named Harry Powers or Henry Powers.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Powers, who was a serial killer. He was a lonely heart serial killer. He was writing women, meeting with them, and then, you know, murdering them for their money.
Yeah,
and
which, again, this, like, sort of compulsory, a woman needs a man.
Yeah.
A woman does not have access to economic prosperity. The Shelley Winters character is a waitress in at a soda fountain.
Yeah.
You know, that's all that can happen to her. So she does, in a sense, need a man as a provider. And you had those very hard gender roles back then.
Yeah.
And here you have this, again, film from 1955 that is showing how exploitable these traditional roles are.
Yeah.
And how, you know, religion and the nuclear family is this incredible trap.
Right.
That leads to her downfall and the beautiful surrealist scene of her dead in the Ohio River in the front seat of a Model T.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just beautiful. I mean, that's the one thing. I mean,
the
film
is amazing.
There are so many individual shots in this film.
Yeah. It's like a
starry
tableau.
Night sky.
Yeah.
All these tableaus that are just beautiful. And then sometimes super creepy Robert Mitchum shows up and you are terrified.
Well, you know, I think the thing for me that's really interesting and the cynicism that is around religion with this particular character is that you find out very early on in the film that he does this, that he finds women who are in need and he exploits them, steals their money and murders them. And so you find this out very, very early in the film. And at one point he's talking to God and he can't remember if it's 6 or 12, like how many women he's actually murdered.
Yeah.
And so there's this amazing cynicism around it because for him it's justifiable because he's feeling that God is leading him to these women.
Is a misogynist.
And he's
for
a massive
his use of
misogynist.
He's a misogynist who's not interested in sex.
Well, I wanted to kind of talk about that when we got to gender, like that, our question. So
let's get into it.
So
I think
it's really interesting because Charles Lawton was bisexual, right? And mm-hmm. so like that was a known secret in Hollywood. And so I've never read the book, but there's these interesting scenes where, so there's a scene where he's watching where Harry is watching a burlesque dancer,
mm-hmm.
and his pocket knife, he presses it and it goes through his jacket, which is very phalic, right?
Yes, which is
very
phallic.
Penetrating. And so it's like this weird play on sexuality because you don't know, is he into women or is he not into women? Is he... And so it's really interesting.
Well, and I think there's this whole repression. I mean, you know, this is also the era when Freud was incredibly popular.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of repression.
Yeah.
And that he, you know, so the marriage to Shelley Winter's character is not consummated. We are there in the bedroom on a wedding night.
Yeah.
When he talks to God when he's driving the car, he's like, I hate all the frilly, perfumey things.
Yeah.
All of these trappings of femininity.
Yeah.
He is ready to lash out at.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, is interesting.
Yeah.
In that sense. And again, Freud was super popular then. So.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's these two things and these two ideas of the perfect Christian nuclear family. Still haunts our politics today. It's still this thing that, you know, I know a lot of our friend group is, you know, in times of pandemic, almost sort of relieved that Christmas is canceled this year, you know, or at least Christmas is limited this year. Because that sense of how people are supposed to live, and if people choose not to live that way,
mm-hmm.
or don't want to live that way, is, you know, it's somehow really evil, really wrong. And I think that's fascinating about this film. That it, and again, this is doing this in the good old, the quote-unquote good old days.
Yeah.
So it's a film that really, in several ways, really resists nostalgia, but yet invokes the American past, invokes the Depression. I think also invokes this sort of Appalachian culture and this, you know, resource curse. These people where, people have to live off the land. There's systemic poverty. And they are tough people.
Yeah.
Because they have to be to survive, you know. And I think that's the other thing. It's not exploitively Appalachian. You know, it's not Hillbilly Elegy.
Oh no.
They're all real characters. They can be very misguided characters, but great characters.
My chair is very noisy. I apologize.
I forgot to oil it.
I have a noisy chair today. Yeah, I think it's also really interesting in the sense too of, you know, going through the Depression and just, you know, because even now with COVID-19, like, you know, you can see how some people might be feeling like they're being punished, right? And that's like the Shelley Winters character who initially, when her husband dies, is saddened, but isn't like, I have to have a man. Like, she obviously loved her husband, right? That died. And he did it, like, you get the impression he did it because, farms are being taken away.
The desperation and depravity and seeing children on the roads.
Yeah.
And that he was driven to this crime, this bank robbery.
Yeah.
Because he never wanted his children to be those kids.
Yeah.
And
which
foreshadows actually what happens to his kids. Yeah. But again, I think we don't like to think about that.
But I think
in
with
our
that
country's history.
But I think with that sense of like, it wasn't until religion came into her life that her husband's actions became punishment for her lack of faith and her lack of Christianity and her lack of God in life. After that, after God, after this horrible preacher coming into her life, seducing her and convincing her to marry him, does it become her husband made that choice? And the sad thing is, like, she takes away the nobility of his choice, right? Like, he was in this pressure to provide for his children. And she ends up saying in a revivalist tent that she pushed her husband to commit this crime because she demanded clothing and makeup. But you actually don't get that sense of her being that kind of character.
No, you don't get her a sense of her being that kind of character at all, no.
Yeah, I mean, even her night of, like, her wedding night with the Robert Mitchum character, with the Reverend, she's wearing, like, this really, like, non-sexiest outfit ever, right? It's just like this, just like this straight, billowy
Night shirt
that does not show anything beyond maybe a hint of collarbone. And he shames her for being lustful with it and for being a fallen type of woman. And how some people will fall into Christianity for support, but you end up taking on these burdens that aren't your fault, right?
Yeah. And the Robert Mitchum character is very reminiscent of an ex-wife of some friends of ours who was evangelical, who also, the potential for a version of Christianity that, as Susan B. Anthony actually once said it, you know, people, beware people who claim to know the will of God, because magically, or the way she said it was more eloquent, it always seems to coincide with their own desires.
Yeah.
And for Robert Mitchum's character, the will of God is the mechanism for his desire fulfillment.
Yeah.
And we definitely know evangelicals in the 20-teens, at least, that that was how they viewed the world.
Yeah.
Was they could rationalize, well, God wants me to. I mean, it is Joel Osteen,
yeah,
actually.
God
Joel
wants me
Osteen
to have a mansion, right?
Yes.
It's God's will that I have a mansion for this.
So we seem to be digging ourselves really far away from the idea this is a Christmas movie, other than it ends on Christmas.
Well, I do think, I mean, so, right, like, there's that question, though, around Christmas and consumerism, right? And this kind of...
Well, I think beyond that, though, is it then the Lillian Gish character... And I think this is really subtle and this is really interesting. It's an interesting maybe critique. This is also maybe something as a way to get around the censors.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, is she the true Christian ideal in the film?
Yeah.
You know, she feeds the hungry, clothes the naked,
yeah,
shelters the homeless.
Right.
Is this symbol of unconditional love when, what was it, Rose, the eldest daughter who, or the eldest stray that she has taken in?
I think it's Ruth.
Ruby.
Oh, Ruby.
Ruby. Sorry, we got the...
There's lots of characters in this.
There's lots of characters, and the nice thing about the Laserdisc format is you get a nice, really extensive blurb, because, you know, these things are 12 by 12 record-sized things. You also get a complete cast list.
Nice.
And so, scene list on the thing. That's why I always, whenever we have a Laserdisc, I always make sure the sleeve is with us. When Ruby... looks for, or Ruby is out like sneaking around trying to meet up boys at the soda shop, and she's the one that Robert Mitchum plays and figures out exactly where these kids are, and he's coming, and the Night of the Hunter is coming.
Yeah.
Instead of scolding her, the Lillian Gish character not only immediately forgives her, but understands her.
Yeah.
You were looking for love in the only way you knew how.
Yeah.
And that you made this mistake, and I love you anyway.
Right.
And we all need love. She says, we all need love.
Right. Which,
And, you know, so there is that element. I think the element of these kids on the run, is it Mary and Joseph? I mean, obviously, the younger child is maybe, what, 3 or 4?
Yeah.
You know,
she also makes a reference to Moses.
She makes a reference to Moses. Yeah. She makes the reference to, you know, Mary and Joseph on the run.
Yeah.
You know, she reads the Bible. She tells the biblical stories to these children every night. And is this incredible force of unconditional love and charity.
Well, so she's a very much like a Christ figure in some ways, right? That she...
And like a true, maybe the true actual read the Bible Christian ideal, or what the best of maybe what Christianity could be,
right,
is embodied in this character, in this redemptive character.
Yeah.
Even as she's, you know, got the shotgun to protect the house.
But she...
Because when push comes to shove, she protects those children with that shotgun.
She's got her shotgun. She's ready with it.
You know, and the great line, you know, when she calls the cops, I got something trapped in my barn.
Yeah. I love this character.
She is the greatest character.
Such an amazing character.
Such an amazing character.
I think coming back to, like, the fact, is it a Christmas movie? Because we actually watched Scrooged earlier in the day.
Yeah, and we thought we owned it on VHS. And we're going to do our Christmas special this afternoon about Scrooged.
Didn't work, but this
we watched it on TV, which doesn't count because they still make TV. And we did order, I won't say, but, you know, our Christmas special next year
is already ordered.
Is already been ordered. A very rare VHS tape off of eBay. A movie that you won't be able to see, but we'll talk to you about it next year.
You know, which is about a man finding redemption because of these, you know, and finding the true spirit of Christmas, which is caring for others and giving. Yeah. And so for me, it is very much she embodies what, like, the true meaning of Christmas should be, which is taking care of others. And it ends at Christmas time. It is happening during...
Yeah. So it's a Christmas movie.
During December.
It's a Christmas movie, and there is a Christmas message.
There is definitely a Christmas message.
And a Christian message in the film.
Yeah.
Even though it's got an evil preacher in it, which I think is brilliant.
That evil preacher, though, is amazing.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about him some more. Robert Mitchum's performance in that film.
Yeah.
There's so much good acting in this film. So,
I want to say it was Gary Cooper. That Charles Laughton wanted Gary Cooper, but Gary Cooper was worried that it would tarnish his career. Where Robert Mitchum is like, yeah, I want this movie, which is Robert Mitchum all the way. Which Robert Mitchum was in Scrooged, actually. Yep. He played the Bob.
Yes, he did. We had a double Robert Mitchum Christmas
did.
Movie.
I haven't watched a Robert Mitchum movie in years. And we
got two in.
Two in. Christmas 2020. He does such an amazing job with this character. He's very menacing. He's very sexual, though he doesn't sleep with it. But there's, like, a power about him.
I mean, I think for those of you who haven't seen it, maybe a reminiscent analog in our own era is Javier Bardem's character in No Country for Old Men.
Yes.
There is a calm menace. Though, there are parts where Robert Mitchum's character squeals like a wounded animal, which is amazing and terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he's part Southern preacher, and then there's these moments where he turns into Nosferatu.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a... I mean...
which is that German expressivist.
Yeah, and he's a sweet talker, and there's a scene where he's trying to get the little girl, Pearl, to tell him where the money is, and... He is, you know, saying, like, your brother is a liar. Don't listen to your brother. He's bad. Yeah. He's no good. You tell me where this is. And she keeps bringing up her brother, and he breaks and says, I'm going to rip off your arm if you don't tell me where this is.
Yes.
And it's just, like, how quickly he turns and how quickly...
Yeah, and I think for the audience, I mean, there's that incredible dramatic irony.
Yeah.
You know, because that's part of it also is, you know, it uses that trope of the kids get it.
Yeah.
Or at least the little boy gets it and he understands.
Yeah.
He's mature enough to understand this guy's evil, you know.
Yeah.
He sees through it when his mom doesn't.
So...
And so the grown-up world is this world of... obfuscation and people making bad choices, and it's the kids who are kind of on their own.
Well, there's that great scene though when he arrives into the town and he's by the street lamp they see him, and I was like, The Exorcist so got that idea from the street lamp. From that movie.
The menacing figure under the street lamp yeah.
was just amazing. I mean, The Exorcist, it's the good preacher, right, who's coming to save the day. This is the, you know, The Exorcist, Father Merritt, is the antithesis of this particular character. But that's how they first encountered him. He is in the night looking at the house and kind of actually surveying his prey, right, and surveying how he's going to become a part of it. And he uses the fact that he's a supposed preacher, which, you know, at that time in the 30s, revivalist itinerant preachers were huge, who just went from town to town with their tent, having these fire and brimstone type of things. And so that's also hard for us to think about that now, right? Because you don't really
have... But I think there are analogs in some of the non-denominational... rock and roll churches that are very... But they're physical structures.
They're physical structures.
But the idea of the roaming, is not a thing.
That's kind of, I mean, you don't...
But
I mean,
that same, I think, short circuit in American Christianity...
Well, I mean, now it's Twitter.
...is definitely in that film.
Now it's Twitter and YouTube that people use.
Instagram.
Instagram. You're not pulling up your tent and going from town to town with your tent preaching.
Yeah. But, you know, I think there are... You know, especially some of these non-denominational, that they don't have an intellectual tradition.
Yeah.
It's what you come up with on the spot and what appeals to people on the spot.
Right.
And the Robert Mitchum character knows enough Christianity and enough scripture to be able to do that on the spot, spontaneously. Yeah. And, I mean, there is a great line in the Roger Ebert review where he calls the townspeople... this chattering gallery of Norman Rockwell archetypes.
Yeah.
Which is true. Yeah. Which is true. But again, that's a great way of saying about how this film is a comment on how America sees itself or wants to see itself or really doesn't want to see itself. Yeah.
This is true.
This is very true. But there's still a true Christian message in the film.
Yeah.
And it ends on Christmas. And they give gifts, and there's charity, and there's a lot of hope in this film.
Yeah.
You know?
And then in the watch that he wanted for Christmas at the beginning of the movie, he gets at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
So it comes full circle. He just had to go quite on the journey to get that particular watch. Yeah,
but he found a home.
He did. He absolutely did.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about? Before we get to the bottom five.
Let's go to the bottom five.
Let's go to the bottom five. All right, I gave away the question already. Is it camp, retro, or classic? Just an old movie. It's a damn classic. You got to see this film. Not all the films in this podcast you should really see. If you want to be a film literate person,
yeah.
I know movies. See Night of the Hunter. See The Night of the Hunter several times. Can't watch it on Christmas because it's getting
late. Don't see the Richard Chamberlain movie remake, which is so bad.
Yeah, no. See the 1955 Charles Laughton, Robert Mitchum, Lillian Gish, Peter Graves, and Shelley Winters.
Yeah.
See it, see it, see it. It's an absolute classic.
And as you mentioned, it's his only film that he directed because of how poorly it was received at the time.
Yeah.
He decided never to direct another film again, which is amazing.
Yeah, which is sad. One and only. America just wasn't ready for it. All right, what about the social political distance?
Yeah, I mean, so we talked about this a little bit about near future. Yeah, near past, right? Near past. Like, there's a near past, there's the...
And I want to say this, too, because even, you know, Ruby at the end, right? There's also this amazing scene at the end. So while these kids are on the run, the adults finally figure out who the Reverend Powell really is.
Yeah.
And so the townspeople are ready to lynch him. They actually, there's a great scene where they have to sneak him out of the back of the county jail. So the townspeople don't take justice in their own hands. And the warden or the executioner at the prison is like, we got to save this one for you. He's like, oh, it'll be my pleasure. And in the beginning, when he kills the dad, he's like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. This is the most terrible thing. And he's really looking forward to hanging Reverend Powell at the end of the film. And everyone hates him. And Ruby is still, but he loved me. And charm and the way Shelley Winters. And you could almost say, like, oh, is he being a misogynist? These female stereotypes. But the Lillian Gish Rachel character, if it's truly misogynist, you wouldn't make a female character like that.
Yes.
They would have found a tough guy, not a tough woman.
Yeah.
And is it also then this critique on compulsory heterosexuality or an idea of submissive womanhood and women who are taught to be submissive and they're good? Because again, when Reverend Powell craps all over Shelley Winters on their wedding night.
Yeah.
Her response isn't, oh God, what have I got myself into? She's like, Lord, make me clean. Make me what he wants me to be.
Yeah.
Instead of being like, well, you were getting annulled.
Yeah.
You know? So in that sense too, it is this really interesting, like, ladies, make your own money. That's the lesson of this film. Make your own money.
Yeah.
You don't need a man. And don't let your elders pressure you into
marriage. I think there's that whole scene where, so Shelley Winters, her husband has been hanged for robbing the bank and killing two people. And she's working at the soda shop, and the older couple who own the soda shop, the wife is pressuring her extremely into getting remarried. And Shelley Winters just says, I don't want a man. Like, I'm fine. I don't want a man. And so there's all this massive, massive pressure on her.
And you got kids, and how are you going to rear kids? And then also that older woman is like, oh, but then also sex is this really terrible thing.
Yes.
And so you actually have this interesting, very progressive, sex positive, like, because that is not a sympathetic character saying, you know, women don't want this.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to maybe what mature
physical line?
Love is.
What's the line she says when she's having sex with her husband? She thinks about her canning.
She thinks she just lies there and thinks about her canning.
Which is this amazing line. But there's this tremendous pressure on Shelley.
Which actually, there is a Victorian marriage manual.
Oh, really?
That says women, A, you're supposed to think about something else, and B, never do it twice in the same night. Immediately when it's over, it said actually good women should nag him about things that need to be done around the house.
Wow.
That's so that amazing. He is exhausted and turned off.
That's amazing. But yeah, so they put all this pressure on her. And then there's a picnic, and at the picnic, you know, they're like, well, he's going to get snatched up. You better take him. You better get him now. You're no spring chicken.
Yeah, and she's such a youthful looking character. And it's a youthful Shelley Winters. And it's like, no, you're done if you don't, you know.
If you don't get married. And she falls for it and falls for him. And, you know, and it is a very brief, quick courtship. And no one questions who is this random stranger showing up saying that he's a preacher.
Yeah, he can go out the Bible.
But on the other side, we have Rachel Cooper, which with Lillian Gish, who was a very wealthy, powerful woman in her own right in the silent era, which is like an amazing person to cast for that role, is such a tough character. Who is
tough but loving,
but an amazing, amazing, powerful character. I adore her so much. Yeah. The only thing I will say is that she has a speech about children abiding. And of course, every time she says abide, I think the dude abides.
But again, I mean, this idea of thinking about vulnerability and how we must care for the vulnerable.
Yeah. And her saying that something about she's a tree with strong branches and roots and that she can...
And she can accommodate many birds.
And I love that. Like, I love that image and I love that, what that says about the power of her as a particular person and how she's going to manage that. Even when she calls the police and they show up and they said, why didn't you call me sooner? She's like, I didn't want to get my floors dirty. Like, I just... Just these amazing, amazing lines. So I do think there's this amazing balance around the female characters. And I, you know, and it's interesting, you know, the Bechdel test, like, yeah, Shelley Winters ends up spending all of her time talking about either her dead husband or the preacher, where Rachel Cooper is like, hey, like, I'm talking about my jaw and children and things that I have to take care of, which I think is really, really fascinating.
Yeah. And I think, again, for me, I read it as there's such a song, like the way that this film expresses the social pressure to conform to those expectations.
Yeah.
And yeah, it and that it contextualizes these choices.
Yeah.
She's not just some baddie boy crazy.
Yeah.
Female character.
No, you're right about that. But
the world has turned her into that. The same way that it maybe turns her husband into a bank robber.
Right. And also, I mean, that kind of concept of if you made a hard bed, you lie in it. And I think that's probably also what she fell into, is that I made a hard bed, I'm gonna lie in it. And this is what my role as the preacher's wife.
Yeah. The technical distance. Question three, the technical distance. Well, it is a period piece.
Yeah.
It is a period piece in its own time, right? Yeah. So, yes, there's old cars. Yes, there's crank telephones. But it's supposed to be the 30s.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, there's a few, if you let yourself go, there is maybe a little suspension to disbelief that you got to have. Again, some of those river scenes are obviously on a soundstage.
Yeah. But, you know, like for
but me... he. Does it, though. He uses that soundstage to create, again, these beautiful tableaus.
Well, in some ways, if you think about it as like a dark fairy tale.
Yes, and... which actually, speaking of the sleeve, this is a quote from Charles Laughton that starts the long blurb on the back of the liner notes, if you will, of the DVD, of the Laserdisc. It's really a nightmarish sort of Mother Goose tale we are telling.
Which, and so for me, some of that, like, expressionist, German expressionism that he brings in, some of those tableaus are almost like what you would see in a children's book, right? Like,
there's that scene where they're on the water and there's the huge, and it's obviously a string spider web because it's super thick. But they sail through the spider web, and it's so creepy and good, and you just got to run with it. Yeah. And again, question four, I think the room test, though, I think as much as we say that, I think aesthetically the film is complete. There's not one rando weirdo shot.
Yeah.
That you don't, or camera effect that you don't see anywhere else. It's suddenly in the film.
Yeah.
The noir elements, the expressivist elements are all there throughout.
He was very purposeful in what he yes. did with the film.
Which I think that's a great way of putting it. Like, even the stuff that might today... Actually, a lot of this stuff still looks better than CGI, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's all purposeful.
Yeah.
And so question five, I think, again, is we've been raving about this film.
It's definitely a keeper.
It's definitely a keeper. You know, somebody gifted this DVD, or this DVD. No, I'm sorry, it's a Laserdisc. I promise, not a DVD, Laserdisc.
It's like a bloated DVD.
It's a bloated DVD. That's why. It's still got lasers, but you got to flip it over.
Yeah.
Our Laserdisc player is a little fuzzy sometimes. Laserdiscs are classic, you know, part of it is sometimes they can be a little glassy.
Yeah.
This is a film where it makes sense, actually, on the format.
Yeah.
Seeing it as a little fuzzy.
But, you know, this film is, it's a very menacing film, and there's not a lot of blood and gore and guts. It's menace. It's
atmospheric tension. Yeah. It's character tension. Actually, the other thing the liner notes compares is the Robert Mitchum character with the Dennis Hopper character in Blue Velvet.
Mm.
Like, we haven't seen a physical embodiment of evil since, you know, or whatever. Yeah,
that's a great...
People hadn't seen it until they saw it again with Dennis Hopper.
That's a great, great way of saying it. And the Reverend Powell is just... This character is menacing and disturbing and terrifying. And he is hunting down these children to kill them. And just how that is all handled... is amazing. And it's this amazing, amazing journey. And again, he creates menace through characterization, through shadow, through noises, through song. And Christian songs, right? Like, that's...
Ringing in the sheaves. Ringing in the
You'll never think sheaves, about that song the same way
we'll
again.
We'll go rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves.
It's that film, it's amazing... For that, it's absolutely me. I would, like, Robert Mitchum freaked me out completely in this movie.
Yeah, it's great. Happy holidays. This is a Christmas movie.
Enjoy.
Enjoy.